You are listening to Punk News Podcast, episode 274. And this is Features Editor John Gentile. Welcome back to the Punk News Podcast. We got kind of a different episode today. Not a real busy news week this week, so we're just going to be hanging out, bullshitting. But we've got a very special guest on today, but we'll get to him in a minute. We've got the usual crew here. First of all, we are here with Managing Editor Adam White, who literally gave a speech to business professionals today about being a business professional. Adam White, tell us, what key should we know to be business professionals?
Well, that was yesterday.
Oh, it was yesterday?
Whatever. No one cares. what do you need to know?
Yes, to be a professional.
You should probably be wearing pants most of the time. Unless that is your business, then take them off, because then you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing. John, I'm dying today. I'm dying. My 3-year old gave me some sort of throat plague, and it's completely fucked me up. And my contribution to tonight's show may entirely be like tambourine accompaniment of whatever you're talking about.
Adam, we'll go easy on you this week. I know we usually scuffle, butt heads, brawl, but this will be a nice, gentle podcast. The shelter from the storm, about last episode.
Soothe me back to health, John.
Supplicate you and anoint you. Also here with us, speaking of a guy that likes to be anointed, we are here with news editor, reviews writer, Ricky Frankel. Ricky Frankel, what's happening?
Nothing. Excited for this podcast. Looking forward to the interview. Should be good.
And we are here with our special guest, a guy that a lot of the punk news kids are really into, a guy that made some pretty big headlines last year. We are here with one of the guys of Movie Life. We are here with Evan Backen of the Movie Life. Evan, what's happening? How you doing?
Good. It's just so you know, it's bacon, but that's okay.
Evan Backen.
Yeah. I wish it wasn't, but it is. But I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Quite welcome. So, Evan, let's talk about the Movie Life first. You know, the band reunited, I guess it was 2014 you guys reunited. Did you ever see a reunion in the cards, or did it come out of the blue? Like, how communicative were you with the other guys before the band got back together?
Totally surprised. I don't speak to any of those guys. We had a sort of a half-assed reunion in 2011, and it didn't go well at all, and it was really short. And I thought for sure after that we were kind of all done with each other. And one of the things that we're going to talk about, hopefully, is this business that I'm doing. But one day when I was walking my dogs, I was thinking about my business. And, when you're starting a business, and I guess you would know this, Adam, from being lecturing on business professionals – sometimes you're not making money because you're sort of, growing something and you're investing all this time and money into, hopefully something down the road. And at that point in time, I was like, Jesus, I could use some money right now. It was just one of those weird nights where I'm like, this is hard. I could use some money. And literally that night, I got an email from Vinny saying, would you be interested in a reunion? And I was like, wow, this is kind of exactly what I asked for. So I guess I have to do this. And when... the timing couldn't have been better. But so the question was, did I see this coming? No. We did reunite, I guess, technically in last year, but we didn't play our first show to February of this year. So, what it's worth.
Do all you guys get along in the band, or is it a cantankerous relationship? How smooth is the relationship between the band members?
It was okay at the beginning, because everyone was excited to do stuff and we sort of were all on the same page and we set these terms, of the way things are going to work and how it's going to be different this time and why it's going to be different and how everyone is feeling differently. It was all about different. And then, within 10 minutes, I'm sure like most reunions, it became all the same. So it went from being very different to being completely similar to everything we always do. So at this point, I'm not doing any more shows. I know there's one more at least on the horizon. I talked to a couple of the guys. I don't really talk to everybody all that often. Like I said, we weren't all that chatty before. And, you know, I think, you know, had things gone a little differently, maybe we do more. But that's the reason why bands break up in the first place. And when you try these things out, you know there's sort of a limited window to do them. And I just did it for as long as I could.
You know, there's the cliche that some of the best bands thrive on hating each other or not getting along. One thinks of Black Flag, one thinks of the Ramones. I'm curious, is that true or is that a romantic view of things?
No, I mean, there's definitely bands that have that dynamic. I think with us, we're just not, we're like five of the most passive aggressive guys on the planet. So there's never been any yelling. There's never really been any arguing. There's always like subtle digging and like weird sort of manipulation, but like it's not there's never been screaming matches, throwing matches, fist fights. It's fairly dull. But I do know of other bands that sort of, like you said, that thrived on that sort of hostility or whatever. And you know, sometimes it leads to good music and sometimes it just leads to fighting.
Well, we'll get to your new interesting project in just a minute.
So sure.
What's your advice to bands that aren't getting along? Should they just break up? should they have a big fight and just, you know, hash it all out? What should they do if there's a conflict or tension? And I imagine most bands have tension because, I mean, how can you really get along with three or four other people at once, you know, all the time?
You know what? Here's my advice, and maybe some of the answer is in what to do when you don't get along. I think every band needs to have, let's say, for lack of a better word, a leader. You know, somebody that just is in charge. And the reason why is because it's impossible to make decisions when everyone else is in charge. So, for example, the movie Life's a Democracy. If five guys have five opinions. And in some instances, some guys shouldn't have an opinion on things. You know what I mean? Some guys really don't need to chime in on every question about merch or every question about shows. And it always seems to me the bands that really work are the ones where there's one or two guys that are really the be-all, end-all, and they do the brunt work of decision-making and the sort of, whatever you want to call it, strategy, strategic planning, design of the band. And I think when that's the case, there's less arguing because, hey, it's really one or two person's way or the highway. And with us, there was always conflict because it's hard to get everyone on the same page. And when everyone isn't, well, who's the deciding factor? What's the route we're going to go? Who's got the say? And I guess in some instances, the way that's fixed is by having a team, you know, a manager that will make those decisions. But even when we had those, it always wound up falling to the five of us. So I would say if you're not getting along, I guess, why aren't you getting along? Is it because you're all trying to have opinions or is one guy having opinions and you don't agree? And I don't think it's worth it when it's, you know, if there's that much conflict, you know, I would say, yeah, probably think about why you're not getting along and maybe do something else.
Well, speaking of doing something else, you know, you've got a new project or a new company. Is it EFT Eft Mega? Is that how you say it?
I say it Eft Mega, yeah. It's well, the EFT is an abbreviation for effort, but a red Eft is a salamander. So when I was a kid, I used to go in the Catskills with my dad on a rainy summer's day, and we would catch red Fs. And so it's sort of the two meanings, you know, the meaning of what it is, effort, and also the sort of homage to my dad.
Well, fair enough. You know, what's interesting is I think it was the third Movie Life album was actually on the Billboard charts in about 2000 or 2001, was it?
Yeah.
And so that's when people were – so you guys have sold a lot of records, but now no one's selling any records at all. So you've got kind of this new digital platform.
Right.
Why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about what Eft Mega is?
All right. It's a music store, basically, where I only sell albums. Every album is generally 7 songs, 20 minutes, and every album sells for the same price, which is $6.25. Out of that, $5 goes to the artists, the rest I take, and most of which goes to cover the costs, you know, to run the site and to pay the credit card fees and whatnot. And basically, why it's different, you know, than other sites like a Bandcamp or CD Baby or whatever, or an iTunes, is, you know, partially that it's only albums and it's one price, but also you know, every artist on there is categorized by scene, which is different than most sites, and they're ranked by effort. So I'm trying to come up with a way that bands, you know, don't pay for exposure. They sort of earn exposure. And then when a customer comes to the site, they're presented with the bands each week that are sort of, you know, working the hardest, the people that deserve their attention. And that's my way of saying, here's a good place to start when you want to look for music. And then from there, you can use sort of the scenes to find other things, you know, that are connected to those artists. So that's it in a nutshell. Basically, I'm selling music because I believe, you know, music should be paid for. And if you give the consumer a good enough product, you know, with enough value, you know, a $6.25 price to have something that'll last your whole life is a pretty good deal.
So what's your opinion of illegal downloading? Was kind of a hotter topic a few years ago.
Yeah.
Now that they're streaming, it's not quite as hot of a topic because right. Now people are more streaming. So what's your stance on illegal downloading or copying digital files or even CDs?
I don't know. You know, I didn't like it, but it was never the biggest deal to us because, you know, look, when we were younger, you'd burn CDs or you'd make a tape. And then if you really liked it, you'd buy it, you know? So it never, you know, really, I never cared all that much because to me, the people that were copying stuff illegally at least were passionate about something. You know what I mean? Like they found ways to get the music they wanted and it sucked that they didn't pay, but they had an interest in it. I think streaming is worse because it's all passive. It's stuff that you're presented with and maybe you don't care about most of it or you click once or click twice and you see things and most of the time they don't come back again and you don't really spend enough time with anything. I think that whole experience is actually worse because without owning stuff, whether or not you paid for it, I just don't think you care enough about the art, about the band, the music, and are willing to listen to albums long enough, sit with them long enough, and then spend time to see bands live. I think when you have things presented that way, unlimited supply, and stuff coming in and out every day, as a consumer, you just don't care enough. And I think the problem is, you know, that everyone knows is that artists aren't getting paid enough, but I think worse is the connection that's going to be lost in time with the artist and the fan where they have access to all this stuff and it just doesn't mean what it used to mean.
You know, on your new system, you rank artists by how much effort they put. How do you gauge how much effort, band members have?
I'm trying. Work in progress. But basically, a lot of ranking systems, right, are either, you know, kind of paid for or they're about, you know, numbers. Who's got the most plays or the most hits or the most Facebook fans. I think effort to me, without giving away every piece of information, is more about the work, you know, and the work is more about playing, how often you play, the types of shows you play, the audience you're in front of, are you growing that audience, the area you're in and how easy or hard it is to play and the time of year. There's all kinds of stuff that make things easier or harder for bands, but most of what it boils down to is actually the hardest part is playing and how much people are actually taking an active role in playing any show they can get their hands on, driving near and far to get there, and when they're there, how many people are they sort of connecting with and picking up along the way.
I also see that I guess all the records on the service are unlicensed to a label. They're all, I guess, artist-owned and artist-controlled. What's the reason for that?
Yeah. Well, there's some that are on labels, but it's the philosophy is always that it's the artist owns it. So even if it's a label, it's usually a license deal where after a term, you know, 3 or 5 years, it goes back to the artist. The theory behind that is, you know, I was on two labels, well, actually three, and they own my stuff. And it drives me nuts because after all this time, they make whatever money was there to be made. They make the brunt of it. They still have final say to this day of what they're going to do with those releases. And I think at the time you needed the labels to, you know, distribute your music, to get you all across the country. And now you don't need it. And the idea of giving up your music to me is insane. I mean, the artist never liked it before, but it was a necessary evil, and I don't think they should do it now, especially because all the things the labels used to do that you don't need them to do anymore. So if they're just giving you a small bit of money, it ain't worth it to give up owning your stuff for it.
Wrapping up, you know, the record industry is in the crapper. It's burning, you know. So what advice do you have to young bands? Should they even consider a label? Should they just put everything out themselves? What advice do you have to young bands?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, there are some labels that I work with because I think they're well-intended. But you got to ask yourself what you're getting out of it. So what's the term? What's the deal like? Is it worth the money? I think in general in this climate, you're better off putting it out yourself, and then sort of, you know, getting the things you want, paying for them. If you want some publicity, hire a publicist. If you want, you know, some marketing advice or other things, you know, you can put together your own team and sort of pay for everything, and then you'll own everything. You'll have control over everything. You just have to work hard or harder, but I think that's, you know, in this day and age, the better way to go. I mean, you might as well be in control of everything.
That's a DIY punk rock at its most core. Evan's website is at eftmega.com. Evan, you know, you're obviously a music fan, not necessarily your favorite record, but what's one record that really has meant a lot to you over the years?
One record that's meant a lot to me?
Or you can name two or three if you want.
I mean, they're all cliched records, you know, like the Pixies, you know, Doolittle or something, or Fugazi, 13 songs, you know, Iron Maiden, Number of the Beast. I mean, those are boring answers, I guess, but I'm no different from anyone else. First Texas is the Reason is a good record.
All right. Well,
anything from the Misfits.
That's what I'm talking about, Evan. That's what I'm talking about. Let's wrap up, Evan. Let's send you out with a tune. What tune do you want to play from the kids? It can be from your service or from your band or from any music you like. What should we send them out with?
You're going to play anything I want.
Anything you want.
You should play a track from this band, Pyro Ohio. They're on my site. They're number one at the moment. They got a new album coming out the 13th called Keepsakes. So anything from them or their new song, which isn't for sale yet but is on YouTube.
Okay. So, well, this is Pyro Ohio. Evan, thanks again for being on the podcast, and we certainly appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate the help and you know, helping me spread the word and the support for the Movie Life as well. So. Thanks for the interest and you know, have a good night.
All right, and thanks again. Talk to you later.
All right.
Bye-bye. Try your life.
And that was "A King's Departure Is Never Silent" by Pyro Ohio. And you can find more info on that over at EFTmega.com. So, John, hey.
Hey.
What's up?
We got some mail, first of all. Oh, you know, actually, we should point this out. Is the reason we had Evan on is because I thought his service was interesting. But like, just to make this clear, like, we talked about his new product a lot because he's trying something. But we didn't take any money or anything like that. We've never taken money to talk to anybody on the Punk News podcast, just to be clear, you know.
It's got to be pretty apparent from our, like, shit production qualities and stuff. You know. General lack of any effort whatsoever. What's in the mailbag?
Okay, well, we got some mail. First of all, this is we got a lot of mail about the shelter in the Adam, what did you call it? Shelter in the Shitstorm versus Newfound World or something with regards to the concept of punk rock.
Oh God, people respond to that?
Yeah, we got quite a bit of responses to that.
Oh boy. All right.
So this is from Aaron. Aaron says, "I also got into punk rock through going through a tough time in my personal life. Without getting too specific, punk rock was a place where people would treat me as a person, where there were people who were like me, and there were people that liked the things that I like. I understand Adam's shelter in the storm argument." And that's what Aaron had to say.
Cool. The next one's going to be like, Adam's a shithead.
This one's from Rick. "I hate Adam. This is from Rick. Rick says, "I don't know if the umbrella from the shitstorm and world of craziness ideas have to be separate. I grew up in the South Bay punk scene." I think he means LA, and here's why. "Well, my brother and I did. My brother introduced me to punk rock. Before it got violent with gangs and surfer jocks, it was a party scene where anything went. I saw the Germs 3 times. It was sketchy sometimes, and there were cliques, but you could find your own clique there no matter who you were. And the music was anything but predictable." And that's from Rick.
Hmm.
And this is addressed to Ricky, our own Ricky. "Ricky, uh-oh. I am moving from Albuquerque, where there is a punk scene, but not a big one. I love punk rock shows and house shows. Where should I go in LA?"
Oh, man. That's a big question. It's a good question, though. There are so, you know, LA is so big. And once you get here, you will see how gigantic it is. And there are so many scenes within the whole LA scene that you'll fall into one of them. I mean, if you're looking for more DIY shows, I don't know. I haven't been to house shows very often here. They're few and far between from what I know. Some cool more DIY spots. I can't give you the address because it's a very, very DIY place, but VLHS in Pomona, if you know someone, can get you there. It's almost like a Gilman. It's like almost like a SoCal Gilman Street. I've only been there twice and it's awesome. The Redwood Bar has some great, cheap shows, but I mean, anything along the Sunset Strip in Hollywood, I mean, the Roxy, the Troubadour, the Viper Room, even the Hollywood Palladium, the Fonda, the Regent, that's downtown though. I mean, they're all over the place. Santa Ana also has some great venues like the Constellation Room and the Observatory. What else? But the Roxy, the Whiskey A Go Go, that place is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. The Roxy's my favorite though. Where else? Los Globos. I think that's there's also the Garage in Ventura County. There's there's it's all over the place. It really depends on where you are going to be in LA. But man, there are so many venues out here that do punk rock shows. But I highly recommend starting off like in Hollywood. That's where most of the ones I go are. So yeah, check those out.
They have that tricky Ricky Frankel's recommendations for the punk rock scene. If you remember a few podcasts ago, I was yelling at Ceremony for covering Oasis when they could have covered Gwar. And my big argument is Oasis is one of the biggest rock bands in the world and they're bland. Why cover them? Thomas, who lives in the UK, had a very different opinion of Oasis. He said, "Just listen to the podcast and I got to be honest that you're way off in regards to Oasis in the punk rock world. In the UK, you could not be farther from the truth. In the US, Oasis never made it. And then I replied, well, what do you mean? They sold millions and millions of records. And then he said, they're a huge band, but in the UK, there's a different feeling about Oasis. They have a whole working class attitude, which endears them to people. And I said, oh, do you mean like Bruce Springsteen in the US? And then he said, yes, you nailed it. Bruce is a bigger artist, but I think in the 90s in the UK, Oasis gave guitar music hope again. Plus, it's very English. I think maybe the USA marketed them as an American radio band, like you mentioned, but their first two albums are pure rock and roll. So Thomas is basically saying that in the UK, Oasis is more like Bruce Springsteen, while here, I guess they're kind of more like just a huge radio rock band.
Hate both of them, so it doesn't matter to me.
Yeah, I mean, I got to say, as an American, the English working class attitude of Oasis went completely over my – like, I don't sense that at all. But maybe if you're English, maybe just by the way they talk and the words they use, it makes sense, you know?
That's possible. Well, it's got to be how, like, they interact with the rest of their scene and how – and I guess how they interact with the media over there as well. I think that, like part of it for us is that – you know, when Oasis was big and well, I mean, I'm speaking as a Canadian here, so I'm a little bit out of it, but like in North America, at least when Oasis was big, you know, it was during this whole era where they were probably all over like MTV or whatever. And like, and that was the, you know, between that and the radio, like that would have been the primary vector by which we would have encountered them. And like the UK in general has like a huge magazine presence for music that, you know, isn't really replicated over here. And like way more, I want to say like way more like popularly consumed music criticism, or at least that's how it's always felt to me. Like, you know, there's a lot more, I think, that, you know, people that are in the UK would have had to interact with the band over time. And, you know, our view is probably pretty skewered. So, you know, I'll give them that. I'm not going to go all hate immediately like Ricky here.
Man, I gotta say, man, I wish USA had like the music magazines. I mean, North America had music magazines like the UK. UK has so many music magazines, and they're pretty cool. I really wish we had like those those big glossy music magazines like they have in the UK. They're so cool.
Well, what I've felt like whenever I've seen a lot of the UK music mags that are still going are that the relationship. At least it seems like it's a little bit different than what we do. I mean, you see so much of the stuff that shows up here in like what do we have right now that's like, you know, like popular national music magazines in North America at any point at this point, like Rolling Stone, I guess, but that's, you know, that's not really entirely what they're talking about anymore. But then like Alternative Press, I guess, for the scene that we're in.
I don't know, Spin maybe? I don't know.
Right, but then
what about New Noise? Is that
Well, the New Noise is growing, but that's regional, not actual free magazine. And there's kind of a difference between a free mag. I mean, New Noise is growing, and New Noise actually is a cool magazine. I don't know if it's quite. It's definitely not the distribution league of Spin and Rolling Stone or even like Paste.
True.
I guess like where I'm thinking at night, and I might be completely off base here, but I feel like there's more of an ongoing popular conversation with UK bands in the UK than there is really here. Like music has been really like relegated off to, you know, just like a, you know, one more piece of celebrity noise here. And I don't know if that's different elsewhere. So maybe you get a little bit of a different conversation. Mm. I mean, of course we're talking about like when Oasis was coming out. So, you know, take this conversation and rewind it, you know, 20 years and maybe it's a bit different then, but you know, John, this is what you get when you slag bands on the internet, and then people who actually know what they're talking about, they're going to tell you.
I feel as though I don't slag that many bands, but every time I slag any band, I get so much blast back, you know? Man, this is from Lindsay. She's written in before. Lindsay is pro-streaming, following up on the Adam White argument. Hey, I have a comment as someone who sacrifices her career often to play music. And I find the best way to support bands when they play live is to buy stuff directly. I do use music streaming services. I used to use Pandora, now I use Spotify because I am broke. And before I buy an album or go to a show, I like to listen to a band and I'll check them out. The best part is that if you like a band on Spotify, they'll recommend similar bands for you to check out, and you can save your money to attend both band shows and meet them in person. So what she's saying is she'd rather buy stuff from bands at the show than buy their record off the shelf, which is true. Bands do make more money from direct sales than, you know, record. They don't make any money from record sales on the shelf, more or less. Access to music is important. If actual album or CD purchase aren't bringing bands in cash to survive, then maybe we need to accept this and search for alternative solutions for bands to get money so bands like Classics of Love can make a living. Otherwise, the problem will just get worse, not better, and we need bands to exist, so there has to be another way so the consumer can access these bands. If music is a business within the capitalist system, there has to be alternatives where the musician, the consumer, and the record label all make out at least okay, because these services aren't going away, and maybe if we embrace access to music, things can change for the better. If I had access to – oh, actually, when I was growing up, we didn't watch TV at home, and there was only one music shop miles away, and no one I knew liked punk. I was wondering, is there music out there like I wanted to hear in my brain? I was dying for punk music or anything like that that I could get my hands on. My babysitter gave me tapes that she had – Public Enemy's Fear of a Black Planet, The Jam, Peel Session, Sex Pistols, and Elvis Costello, but I wanted to hear more so badly. There were no college radio stations where I grew up, and we didn't have the internet. There were no local venues that had music, and I was in rural New Hampshire. If I had access to female-fronted punk bands my whole life, then my life would have been different. No one told me musical geniuses could start a band, and I knew of no female musicians. I thought that you had to be super cool or super popular or really talented to play. How could I learn? It never even occurred to me that making music was an option to someone like me. When I found punk bands like the Slits, I couldn't believe they existed. So not having access to music has made me super obsessed with it. Now I spend so much time searching out music and listening to records because I can hear everything and it's like a dream come true and I can barely handle it. It's probably not healthy how much I love music, but I feel so fortunate to have access to it. So Lindsay saying that streaming music is a way to educate oneself and to expand one's horizons, if you will.
Cool. And they mentioned Classics of Love there just to butter you up and get you on their side.
Mm-hmm, indeed. Indeed. Well, if you want to get on my side, then be pro Classics of Love. So that's our mail. As always, you can reach us at podcast@punknews.org. Honestly, not a whole lot of news this weekend. Some of the news this week wasn't even really that great. So we're just going to chill out, hang out. You guys want to talk about record? You guys want to play a song? What do you guys want to do?
You know what? I'll play a song and then we'll pop back in, blow through some news, and then we'll see what kind of time we have left on the clock.
Sounds good.
So I'm gonna play a song by a band out of the Toronto noise punk scene called Soup Cans. They have an LP coming out on the Telephone Explosion label called Soft Party. It's coming out on November 17th of this year. It is a 13-track album. It includes this wonderful, crazy, noisy, all-over-the-place track called Siamese Brutality. So this is Soup Cans from Toronto with Siamese Brutality.
And we are back, and that was Siamese Brutality by the Soup Cans.
Soup Cans.
Soup Cans. That was cool, Adam. I love it when you bring the hard and the hardy Canadian punk rock, the nasty stuff. Speaking of unusual music, Cassie Ramone of the Vivian Girls, of the Babies, of OCDPP, and also of Melt It, and also of her solo career, she's announced a very interesting record. Cassie Ramone of the Vivian Girls, of the Babies, is going to be releasing a Christmas album. She's going to be covering 10 standard Christmas tunes. No one knows if she's just going to play them straight or if she's just going to make them weird and wacky. I got to say, fellas, I'm a huge Vivian Girls fan. I like all the Vivian Girls spinoff bands, La Sarah, the Babies. I like them all. I'm intrigued, and I'm curious if she's going to play it straight or do, like, weird versions. And further, let's assume she's going to play it straight. Does the modern music scene have room for a standard Christmas record?
There seems to always be, like, a void for one or two. It's kind of inevitable, I think. But from who it is, from which artist, it's up in the air.
I don't know exactly where these kind of records get played anymore. And even the few that have come out that I've heard that I've even kind of liked, I still don't exactly know like what the context is in which I'm going to play them. Like Chris Farren had that Christmas EP that he put out last year or the year before, and you know there's some really nice little pop songs on there, but like. Still, like, I don't know when I'm ever in the mood to hear even like original Christmas music outside of like, I don't know, I guess like Christmas Day. So, you know, it's a weird, it is absolutely like a weird prospect. Cause like, I don't know if you can count on those selling, especially if you're a, you know, esoteric little indie artist, you know, I guess if you're like, you know, the Bing Crosby estate or something, you could put out another Christmas record and people are going to buy it. But I don't know. Like, John, like, do you rock Christmas records?
I do. I rock Christmas records exactly on December 23rd, December 24th, and December 25th. I listen to specifically the Jacob Miller and I Roy Christmas record, which is great. I've got a reggae Christmas record, which is great. I listen to the classics on the radio. I love the classic Christmas tunes, Silver Bells, Jolly Old King West, all the classic Christmas tunes, you know, the Frank Sinatra, the Bing Crosby. And I also like the modern pop Christmas tunes, pop Paul McCartney. I love the Waitress's Christmas rapping. So, I mean, I think this is not going to be like the greatest record I ever heard, I don't think. But I think it's going to be cool. I enjoy the weird little Christmas record. I think the point for this is not to be some big grand statement, but just a fun little diversion. And I think it's going to be cool. And I'm going to buy it. I'm going to play it on December 24.
Yeah, you know, and also to Adam's point, I mean, when was the last time anyone has listened to that Bad Religion album that came out? Was it last year or the year before?
Yeah, well, good, like, never. Good point. I mean,
yeah,
people didn't even listen to that when it came out.
Yeah, I know, like, that went towards some like cause, but still, like, I just didn't see much of a point after that.
Well, but yeah. Fair enough. But does a record need to have a point? Can a record be a thing of pure whimsy? I vote yes, and that's what I think this is.
It can, but when you do a Christmas album, there is a point because it's Christmas.
But I mean, what's wrong with just saying we're going to do this record just for fun that you don't even play that much, but you play once in a while? What's wrong with that?
There isn't.
You're wrong, Ricky.
No, there isn't. It's just, you know, I think artists should just set their expectations for these, you know, very targeted albums.
But you are being presumptive that she thinks this is going to be a Billboard top seller. Maybe
not that, but I mean, I think, like, I agree, like, this is something, but like an act like Bad Religion, I wasn't exactly sure what they were trying to do.
Bad Religion is a little bit more curious because, like, they are like anti-religion, sort of, at least, you know, I mean, their name is Bad Religion. So, I mean, were they being serious or were they like making fun of religion? It wasn't exactly clear. I think Adam White voted they were just doing it just for fun and really didn't have any grand statement to it. I think that was your vote from last year, Adam.
Yeah, that's a weird egg of a record. I still don't know what I make of that one, to tell you the truth.
Is Bad Religion covering doing a Christmas record? Is that perhaps the most genius record to ever be released? The most mysterious record to ever be made?
Well, from what I remember, wasn't the – I mean, I vaguely remember the cause for that record being like like they give the proceeds to some like charity that helps like kids that were molested by priests or something.
Yeah, I think you're right, actually.
So maybe that's the only reason they did it, just as like this, you know, big anti-religion statement or something like that. I don't know.
That was a weird thing, but you know,
yeah, it was.
I don't know. I mean, even I think about that now, and I'm like, there is still, you know, if you wanted to raise money for that cause, you could do it without having to like put the whole band through like having to go into the studio and record something. You could just, you know, do a benefit show. But I don't know.
Yeah.
Not for me. Let's talk about some other stuff that happened this week. These are all going to be kind of brief stories, nothing too dramatic. After more than 20 years, I'm going to spit out the lozenges that's in my mouth. So well, I can actually read this story.
Is it those delicious cherry ones, Luzins?
It is a Ricola lozenge.
Oh, that's nasty. Those things taste like gasoline.
Well, it's what I wish it did. It's not fucking working. Anyways, after more than this show is not sponsored by Ricola and their weak ass lozenge.
Ricola! After more than
20 years with the band, guitarist Todd Morse has left the hardcore stalwarts H2O. Morse says, "I grew in a different musical direction, and you can't fake it in a band like H2O. The fans are so loyal because every song is real and from the heart." So Morse is now going to concentrate on a project he has called Todd's Planet, which is all one words and written in caps, at least according to Punk News, which features a danceable rock rhythm section as well as horns and a mix of male-female vocals. Morse said, "It is a very soulful kind of vibe. It's the first thing I've done that's 100% my dream band. I like the idea of making people feel less uptight and shaking them out of their shells the way that rock and roll did when it first hit." So there you go. That's what he's doing. Morse's former band, H2O, just released a record called Use Your Voice, and that came out last month. And people seem to like it. So, you know, you got that. But anyways, Todd Morse out of H2O into Todd's Planet. What else we got going on? Ricky, a bunch of your bands.
Yeah, I mean, Leftover Crack, new song, Bedbugs and Beyond. I'm into it. It has a little bit of a Starfuck and Hipsters vibe to it. But you know what? I really love this. I'm getting more and more excited about this album. This is just amazing. After 10 years of fans waiting, Contract of the State's finally coming out. The Fat Records pre-order was Monday, so I pre-ordered the shit out of this and got the color version on vinyl. And then related, we can go into this later. Ezra Kyer was on the English Anxious and Angry podcast, but first, what did you guys think of this tune? And what do we think about this being the first record, a Leftover Crack record, without Ezra Kyer?
Well, I think this record is it's going to be good. I think it's good. I think it's going to be their most hardcore record. Not that it's going to be a hardcore record, but it's going to be, I guess, probably their most serious or their most darkest or their most jagged sounding record. I think there's not going to be a lot of fun on this record, but there is going to be a lot of smashing and thrashing and basically tough music, which I'm excited for. Do I miss Ezra being on the record? Certainly. I think one of the great dynamics about Leftover Crack is kind of, you know, well, Scott Sturgeon, Ezra Kyer, and I always thought it was Kyer, but maybe it is Kyer. I think it's Kyer.
I think it's on the Anxious and Angry podcast. It was they said Kyer,
but I think it's Kyer. We'll find out eventually. Brad Logan, Scott Sturgeon, and Ezra, they're each three different songwriters, and they merge together very well. You know, Scott Sturgeon has the most, you know, I guess, nihilistic view, if you will, even though I don't know if he's true that nihilistic, but he's got the most crusty songwriting sensibility. I hate that word, sensibility. Style, if you will. Whereas Ezra Kyer is more of a ballad writer or more of an epic songwriter. I thought they meshed together extremely well. So without Ezra, will the new Leftover Crack record be worse? I don't think so. I think it'll just be different. And honestly, I mean, I remember when Rob Halford left Judas Priest, people were bummed out. But I don't know if you're going to get less good music. You're kind of getting more good music because I think the Leftover Crack Rag is going to be great. And I know the Morning Glory stuff is great because they Morning Glory released two phenomenal albums. So
and that EP, the Born in December EP was phenomenal too.
So would I like to see them together? Yes, but they're apart, and you just kind of have to accept it. And we're getting good music on both sides anyway. So you got to move on, you know.
So yeah. Tell us about what Ezra's doing.
So I mean he's doing Morning Glory, but I got to the first of all the episode that he was on was episode 93 of the Anxious and Angry podcast. It was very revealing. They talked about why he left Leftover Crack, his time in Choking Victim. If you're into this stuff like I am, this is and you don't listen to this podcast, this is one where you should really like. It's a great narrative about what happened and why he left. He also talks about how it turns out he and Nico from Starfucking Hipsters actually dated on and off for quite a long time, which actually threw a lot into the mix of why he left. But I won't give too much away. But he's been after, you know, every once in a while he'll throw out a solo tune. I think like a year or year and a half ago, there was a song called Civilian Song that came out. That was just him. And I think just piano and acoustic guitar. That was quite good. But then I'll give you the exact minute, but at an hour, 33 minutes and 36 seconds, he chooses to let Ryan play a solo song and then a song off War Songs.
It almost seemed like he didn't want to, though. Did you notice that? Like,
yeah, he was very, very like he felt. You could tell he was feeling kind of vulnerable. And who knows if this solo project will actually come out? But I gotta tell you, this song is called "Let It Go," and it kicked ass. It's like a softer Morning Glory song with still those big guitars, the big guitar octaves. And I mean, damn, he just put his heart out on the line for this song. And it is so fucking good. That's why I had to post it. On Punk News because since it came out, I've just been listening to that part of the podcast, over and over again. Cause I think it's such a great song. John, did you listen to the whole thing? Did you just listen to the song?
I did, and it is an excellent interview. I gotta say, as an interviewer myself, I'm always checking my own skills and seeing what I can take from other people. What's interesting about Ryan is he doesn't ask great questions, but he gets great answers, you know.
Yeah.
And so that's a great interviewer. So I don't know why that is. It's just, I mean, Ezra Kirei is a super interesting. He's one of the most interesting interviews I've ever done. Maybe it's because Ezra is so interesting, or maybe it's just maybe Ryan has mastered emitting a certain what's the word I'm looking for, atmosphere, so people just open up without him even asking complex or clever questions. He asks very simple questions, which if I read it on paper, like if an interviewer gave me these papers, these are questions I'm going to ask, I would say you need to beef up your questions. But he got great answers, so you can't fault that. So the interview is really good. You should listen to it. The new song, I think it probably won't be released because Ezra said he didn't want to release it. Maybe right. It will, maybe it won't. And all those guys have a ton of – Brad Lowe's got a ton of unreleased music. Ezra's got a ton of unreleased music. I think Scott Sturgeon does not have a ton of unreleased music, but I'm not sure about that. But I think it probably won't be released. I thought it was cool. Ezra really is a phenomenal. He really knows how to write a ballad or an epic song, and that's his core strength. Although, honestly, I'd love for him to come out with just another kick-ass punk rock record. You know, hard-charging, jacked-up music, maybe with some of the more epic, soaring tunes, you know.
Yeah. Now, back to Ryan Young's interview style, I think he gets first of all, I listen to his podcast regularly, he has a flow now. He definitely has a flow that he sticks to, but he gets great results. But I think artists are willing to open up to him because he himself has gone through most, you know, a typical artist, you know, a touring artist thing, experience. So I think they're able to open up a lot more to him because they understand as like, you know, whether I, you know, my interviews or your interviews, we don't really know what it's like to be on the road and recording the next album and hoping it's great.
True, insightful.
And also, I just want, you know, at this point, I just want Morning Glory to tour.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they did Australia like a year ago, and then they did Pooza Fest, and then that was it. I am dying to see them. I know they did the Off With Their Heads tour also, I think like a year and a half ago. But I mean, I'm hoping they put out new stuff because it's fantastic. I know they have a Post-War Songs EP coming out sometime on that new label, Buyback Records. But who knows? I think Ezra is one of the most interesting musicians out there. I think he's incredibly talented, and I totally fanboyed when we had him on the 250th episode. So I don't want to get too much into it, but still,
and he's a cool guy. Awesome. He's a cool guy. He's down. He's cool.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't want to keep dragging out my admiration for Ezra Kyer, but Adam, do you have anything to throw in?
No. I adore your leftover crack fandom. So I'm just gonna let it happen here. You have a song that's related, right?
Yes, I do. So the band typically Leftover Crack will throw in a one or two covers, whether it's a Choking Victim cover or a Morning Glory cover, but obviously it's
or a no commercial value cover.
That's true. Or a no commercial value cover. Obviously there won't be a Morning Glory cover, but there are two covers on this album. One is called The War at Home. That's an introspect record, off the introspect record, Real Politic. That's because the two newer members of Leftover Crack were in introspect. But they also covered a Blackbird Rom song, which they've been touring with this year pretty much, called Last Legs. And I'm really interested to see how they cover such an interesting song. The Blackbird Rom's a very, very folk-based punk band. I mean, there's no guitars. It's just like mandolin, banjo, violin, that kind of thing. But the song Last Legs is off their album Destroying, which came out in March this year. And I reviewed it. I think it's really, really good. I gave it, I think, an 8. It came out on Silver Sprocket. When I first saw them open for Leftover Crack in February, though, I was blown away. It's such a dark show. It's a really dark album with great vocals. So yeah, it came out on Silver Sprocket. You can check them out on facebook.com/blackbirdrom, Twitter, they're at blackbirdrom. They have blackbirdrom.net. And then
is Blackbird Rom paying you money?
I just want to give them a fair plug. These guys really deserve it. They've been working hard.
Actually, let's talk about plugs. I mean, people like say you can find us at such and such. I find that's not necessary, because if I say Classics of Love is great, someone's going to find out how to find Classics of Love. You know what I mean? Like, I think people don't need – I mean, I'm not talking – I think people plug stuff. I think it's unnecessary. You know, now that Google exists, I think people know how to find stuff. Adam, do you agree?
Yes and no.
Actually, Adam, you're like the social media expert. advise.
I mean – yeah, for the most part, people are going to be able to Google stuff and find it. That said, if, you know, bands often give themselves, you know, the worst names possible as far as being able to actually find things. So, yeah. You know, in these cases, if you're, you know,
Google the band,
one of these bands that has like a, you know, a really clever name with stupid punctuation in it that you know, sounds like a generic word, then, you know, maybe it makes sense to give out their thing, although, you know, if your Google foo is if it's strong, you can probably still find them. But you know.
All right. Well, I have one more. Blackbirdrom.bandcamp.com. Rom is spelled RAUM. For those of you who didn't get that, here's Last Legs by Blackbird Rom.
treacherous wheels, spinning place and throw up mud. The perforated loom, thick smoke presses down. It'll be foam in the bogged down inertial stench, decaffeinated law. Mud makes motion low.
That was Blackbird ROM. You heard a whole bunch of links earlier. We just wanted to just touch base on something really quick. We ran last week's podcast. We spoke about Brandon Carlisle, the drummer of Teenage Bottle Rocket, who at the time of our recording was in hospital and in a coma. And Brandon died on the night of November 6th, 2015. Just before that show would have hit the air. That this has been spoken about far and wide. I don't think it's been a corner of the, you know, the punk scene online that hasn't, you know, spoken about this or been touched by this or, you know, seen memorials go up or anything like here. So, you know, we can't really do him a lot of justice on this show, but I just, you know, just for the sake of continuity, I just wanted to make that, you know, just to, if you haven't seen, that was the outcome of it. So you can find the full statement from the band over on Punk News. And our condolences, of course, go to the Carlisle family and their friends and their fans and all that. So, wanted to make mention of that one because it was kind of left in limbo on last week's show.
Yeah, so, I was wondering, this is really tough. Everyone, there's a whole ton of support on social media. The band actually started trending. And I believe the GoFundMe account in 6 days, I'm looking at it now, raised almost just about $45,000 in 6 days, which is, that's pretty great. But again, this is a really tough situation. I mean, to lose, a brother, but I mean, at the same time, to lose a twin must be ridiculously tough. And I hope the band will continue on and get through this. But yeah, again,
I cannot even imagine what those guys are going through. So,
oh yeah. It has to be all
of our love to Teenage Bottle Rocket and the Carlisle family and all that. So,
exactly.
So yeah. John, we have anything else that you want to make mention of this week? You want to touch on, if anyone wants to write us email, of course, podcast@punknews.org is how you do that. But outside of that, what do you got?
Well, you guys want to hang out or you guys want to wrap it up? I got one thing we could talk about.
Shoot. What do you got?
It is the 18th. No, I'm sorry. The 38th anniversary. That can't be right. 28th. It's one of the anniversaries of Give Him Enough Rope this week by The Clash. I got to say, man, I just recently got the remastered version of that. First of all, I got the 1999 remastered version of that. First of all, those Clash remasters, they did a great job on those.
Oh, yeah. The remasters sounded really good.
Go ahead, Adam. I'm sorry.
These are the ones that would have come out...
99,
yeah. So that was like where they CD reissued everything, and there was like a big super deluxe version of London Calling that they put out at the same time, I think.
No, that was like 2005 or 2006.
That was okay, no, but
that was the same master, the 99 master, but that had two extra discs.
Right, okay, yeah, but the same masters. Yeah, anyways, those sounded very, very good. It is the 37th anniversary of Give Him Enough Rope.
Wow.
So the first thing to address with it is the remaster. They really did a nice job on those remasters. Have any of you guys heard of the newest remasters? I haven't heard any of them yet.
I have not.
Well, I think these are the ones that came out with the Clash Box.
Yeah, well, they released them separately and as in the Clash Box. Have you heard the newest remasters?
No. I mean, outside of, it's possible that those are the ones right now that they're using for like all the streaming stuff, but that's streaming stuff, so who knows how it sounds anyways, right? So no, I haven't heard them at all.
Yeah, I want to check them out, but I can't imagine they sound much better than, I mean, the 99 masters, they sound great. The question, people off, like, you know, there's a lot of Give Him Enough Rope kind of gets lost between the first and third Clash album. You know, London Calling is where the band really made their quantum leap. The first album is an iconic, unique, powerful statement. But man, I mean, I've been rocking out to Give Him Enough Rope. Give Him Enough Rope is kind of fantastic on its own right. I mean, it's kind of as good as, well, I'm not going to say it's as good as London Calling, but it's kind of as good as the first album, and that's saying something. You know, I mean, Safe European Home, Julie's been working for the Drug Squad. It shows the band taking risks and growing, but it still rocks, man. It's a great record.
Yeah, Tommy Gunn's a great song also. I mean, this is a great little, not little, but great. This is a great album. I just have it on MP3, but what did they just remaster it? Was there anything different that they did compared to the original release?
You mean for the 2014 remasters?
Yeah, or the 99.
Well, the 99 remaster, they just, you know, ran the tapes through and ran them through the computer. And they, I mean, the old CD reissues from like the 80s or early 90s, they sound like crap. But, right, you know, all those CD reissues do from the 80s, they all sound like junk. The 99 remasters sound powerful, loud, but they're still arranged there. I haven't heard the newest ones. Those were overseen by Mick Jones, where the 99 Masters were not overseen by Mick Jones, so I'd be interested to hear him out. But on the other hand, you know, I mean, artists fiddling with their – and we can talk about this too. Why is it that when artists fiddle with their older work, it's never satisfying? It's never like, oh, this is so much better. You know, Iggy Pop famously remastered Raw Power in what – like not in like 2000, 2001, and he kind of made it like way worse. They went back to the original Bowie masters. Why do you guys think that artists meddling with their own work is often frustrating for fans?
I think it's because the thing that you fell in love with was the imperfect version. So, you know, those reduxes might very well be like objectively better or better according to. Well, I guess maybe, you know, better according to the artist, but that's not the thing that everyone kind of grew to love. It's gonna be, you know, by its nature, a different version of that. And I don't know, you know, I don't know if who that benefits other than making the artist maybe more satisfied with the product. But I mean, it's kind of ignoring the fact that the original is the one that had the cultural. The cultural impact, the cultural reaction to it. So, you know, that's I've got to imagine something like that. But I just want to like just thinking about giving enough rope here, though, remasters or otherwise. This was definitely like the least weird of the Clash records. Like a lot of the early singles that ended up mixed into the self-titled one, especially the U.S. release of it, you know, it made it more of a strange listen, I guess, compared to some of the, you know, some of the other stuff that had been released at that time. You know, stuff like White Man and House at Hammersmith Palais, like those songs where the band was like experimenting with ska and reggae and doing that kind of stuff. You know, it made it more of a varied listen. Like, Give Them Enough Rope is a straight-up rock record, and it is the least experimental of really anything that The Clash did. And it's sort of nice for that reason, in that, you know, for a band that does go all over the place on some of their later records, like, here they are doing, you know, we're going to play 10 punk rock songs and, you know, and not really deviate from that and not go anywhere else and not... you know, not try to do anything particularly, you know, esoteric on it. But, you know, for a band that does go all over the place, it's nice just to have that kind of like little compact set. It's funny though, because like I'll listen to Give Enough Rope and I'm thinking like, there are some bands these days that like, it feels like they've written Give Them Enough Rope like six times. Where like you look at a band that like everyone loves that maybe doesn't go too far outside of their comfort zone. I'm thinking like, I don't know, like take like a band like say like the Bouncing Souls or something like that, right? Where, you know, they have some varied stuff, but really Bouncing Souls songs all kind of sound like Bouncing Souls songs, and that's great because I love them, but you know, they've been in a way they've been writing their own kind of like Give Them Enough Rope over and over again, and I feel like a lot of bands these days are like that, and like that they would hit kind of like they would hit this plateau where they go, you know what, we can really competently crank out, you know, a set of 10 rock songs, and they kind of stop there. And Give Enough Rope is maybe interesting in that The Clash didn't stop there, you know?
Do you think The Clash should have been more daring on Give Enough Rope? It's Given Them Enough Rope them instead of charging forward, hesitating?
I don't know if it was hesitating as much as it was them maybe coalescing before they kept going. This band would have an entirely different legacy if they, you know, if they would have, not if they would have stopped here, but if they wouldn't have done any of like the stylistic flourishes that they did post this record. So it's like it's an odd one in that, like, you know, we don't really talk about it all that much because it's not, I don't want to say it's not interesting, but it's not blowing anyone's mind, you know.
What's interesting is the amount of ground the Clash covered between 1976 and 1983. That's only 7 years. I mean, it is insane how far that band progressed in 7 years. If you compare it to, I don't know, what's the modern punk rock darlings? I don't want to diss on anybody, But I mean, think of bands that are popular, punk news, or bands that I like, bands that everybody likes. Like, has your favorite band really progressed that far in 7 years? And the Clash went from White Riot or Janie Jones all the way to First Night Back in London or Long Time Jerk. You know, it's crazy.
Yeah, it really is. And I think that's the fact that they had that progression is what, you know, in retrospect makes this, you know, an interesting record in that set. So, totally odd thing for you to pick up on, the 37th anniversary of Give Him Enough Rope. But yeah, I guess it is today.
Well, it was kismet, because I've actually had the non-remastered version for a while. And then I saw the remastered version last week for like $4. So I bought it. And then just today was the 37th anniversary of the record.
That's the big anniversary, right? Everyone always cares about the 37th. Yeah. Oh, that was a weird seg, John. Well, we talked a little bit about Give Enough Rope. That's not the Sandinista podcast.
No, maybe we should have done it this week. We got to do the Sandinista podcast. Listeners, I'm going to put together a plan. We're going to modify the plan to fit it how we want. We are going to do the Sandinista podcast. Maybe next week. If we got another slow news week like this week, we're doing Sandinista next week. We're doing it by the end of the year. Well, we're doing it by February. We're doing the Sandinista podcast by February, because we usually have – actually, maybe we should do it in January, because that's always a slow time. Sandinista podcast in January. January is always a slow time period. That's when we're doing Sandinista podcast. Write it down. Give them enough rope. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Fun fact before we leave this show, before we get off of Give Them Enough Rope here. The piano on – Julie's been working on the for the Drug Squad – Alan Lanier of Blue Oyster Cult.
Ooh.
Uncredited.
I did not know that. Was that one of the things that happened in the 70s all the time? Like, he just happened to be in the studio, so they pulled him in and used him?
like that guy in particular? Like, he was hanging out?
No, but like, that happens all the time in the 70s. If you look at these records from the 70s, because bands were putting out one record per year or more at the record label requirement, bands were always in the studio. And so all these people you wouldn't expect to be on each other's records are there just because they happened to be at the studio at that time. So they showed up and just said, "We need somebody to play this. Can you play it?" And they said, "Yes."
I'm sure that happens a lot. This one was probably more of a call, because remember, Sandy Pearlman produced Give Him Enough Rope, and he was, you know, really famously associated with Blue Oyster Cult, really more than anyone. So, you know, it was probably like they were like, shit, we need a piano player. And he, you know, pulled out his, you know, 1970s cell phone and made a call.
It's nice. Burn out the day, burn out the night. I'm burning for you.
When was this? 1978? Yeah, no cell phone. What did they have then? Pigeons?
I think they had those like wooden boxes on the wall that you cranked and spoke into.
One of those like tin cans with a string.
Well, thanks for listening to the Punk News Podcast. You know, nothing wrong with chilling and hanging out once in a while.
No.
Well, John, I got to say, you've not solved my cold. You've not fixed my sore throat. If anything, speaking to you has made it worse. So,
well, doing most things with me makes it worse. Oh. So get used to it, society. We'll see you next week.